Hi, my name is Angela Lewis from Org Culture Bites. Thank you for joining us in this podcast series, where we'll be talking to a number of Australians who are local thought leaders and experts making a positive impact on Australian workplaces. Today I'm going to be speaking with Paulina LaRocca, our local creative catalyst. Paulina has over 15 years' experience training people in the science of creative problem solving and inspiring real-life business innovation. She's held roles internally, such as the Global Creativity and Innovation Director for Pernod Ricard Winemakers, and now she runs her own business. Paulina works with clients from around the world to inspire creativity and innovation through her workshops, her tools, and also by tapping into her rich expertise to develop critical skills and mindsets around growth. So welcome, Paulina, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us to talk about all things creativity today. We're thinking about creativity in particular in the workforce. So how would you define that?
Creativity is the catalyst to innovation, but I think it's a poorly understood cousin of innovation. The two actually need to go together if you want to have really kind of exciting and enduring innovation. But people kind of feel more comfortable with innovation because I think that design thinking has done a great job of actually codifying it and putting a process behind it and making it rigorous. We have this feeling that creativity is more, to even go back to Greek myths, more muse-like. We don't know how to actually get it. We don't know how to cause it. And also that it seems to be undefinable and lacking that clear structure and link to outcomes that innovation has. It's interesting. So one is kind of the serious good and the other one's kind of almost fluffy bad within the corporate sense. And it's really understanding that the two are actually linked, and sometimes the two are the same sides of the same coin, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's understanding that creativity as well has a structure around it, and it's not something that is divined. It actually is something that, with rigor and tools, it can actually almost be manufactured. It certainly can be produced in an organized way, and it can drive outcomes that are beyond just business products and services. That's where innovation has tended to lie within the corporate sector, whereas creativity actually can touch you intrinsically and actually get to your personal beliefs and emotions much more effectively than innovation usually does.
Interesting. So what I'm hearing there is that innovation can be directly linked to business performance, and there's that very clear linkage that's really important to be able to invest in innovation because it gives you results. Creativity seems to sit behind that. So what you're saying is that creativity itself is an indirect link to business performance, and that when you're considering introducing greater creativity in the workplace, it's about linking it to specific problem solving or having the boundaries around how does this balance with business performance and the results we're trying to achieve. So is it about putting creativity in the context of particular problems to solve, or a linkage to particular goals around innovation that lead to business performance?
I think you can do both. Mm-hmm. And I think that when creativity is linked in some way to innovation or to actually looking at problems that the business has in different ways of actually solving it. And sometimes innovation's about performance or products or services, whereas creativity can be used to solve any business issue, cultural and or, yes, we need a new product or service. So it actually has a broader remit usually than an innovation team or department has. But I think the fact that by introducing it alone, it actually in and of itself can drive business performance. Mm-hmm. Because it's a softer skill, people don't really understand that. And I think what I would like to see is recognition that as much as innovation has processes around it, creativity as well has rigor and structure. Mm-hmm. And it can be used to release people's potential. And really it's about saying, do you want your people to be actually asking you to solve things and kind of seeing things that need to be solved and not doing anything about it? Or do you want your people to feel motivated and inspired to work with the organization to make the organization a better place, no matter how small their remit is? They don't need to be the leader. They can all make positive changes that actually can impact the overall health and culture of an organization.
I love the points that you make that link directly to culture, because culture is about your underlying beliefs and assumptions about the world and how things should be, or how you'd like them to be.
Yes.
and often I think creativity, like you said, is put in that space of being softer skill. But as we see our workplace environments evolve, we've come from a very highly structured way of thinking and organising the workplace to a highly disrupted workplace now, as you know, different technologies, different market forces are at play, and we're needing to be more agile. So I find that there is a greater focus on, and I don't want to call them softer skills because they're not soft, they're actually, they're hardcore because they are difficult and they are hardwired into the DNA of your culture. These human performance skills around creativity and empathy and problem solving, that we're seeing much more of an emphasis. You know, when we look at the context of workplace environments and culture now, where does creativity fit in a work culture, and how have you seen it be a driver of performance?
I think creativity sits in the work culture more solidly now, but I think more in the play arena. And I think the benefits of the tech companies and also the disservice that the tech companies have done is they've kind of introduced the concept of playing and, you know, having a ping pong table or a foos machine and kind of ways to relax and stuff like that. And the Googles of this world are seen as creative workplaces and almost the gold standard. However, I find there's a distinction between being playing and playful. And what I'd like to actually see is more playfulness and less playing. Because I understand that businesses might kind of think, well, if I put a foosball machine in, et cetera, that's just going to have my employees, you know, slagging off and stuff. It's not that at all. It's about having a more playful touch to business. And I think that's about not necessarily taking everything so seriously, but also being able to be more trusting, more joyful, more bringing your full self to work and being who you are and being able to contribute at a deeper level than just kind of fitting a suit, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Even though we have less suits these days, we're more casual workforce. Mm-hmm. It's still the same thing. It's trying to fit into a box. So I think if you want your employees to actually truly bring their full potential, then I think that understanding creative behaviors and the creative mindset definitely is an asset. Mm-hmm. And then I think when it comes down to culture, and I've seen personal experiences, when you release people and you actually say that we acknowledge that you can think differently and that you are empowered to actually make change when you actually see opportunities, it's like people's lights go on. It's like lighting up a Christmas tree. People think, I can make a change. I can make a difference. And it allows them to actually kind of release themselves from their own constraints, because sometimes these constraints are not even real. It's not like the organization says, no, we don't have this. It's kind of like we just assume that there are rules there that sometimes are not even real rules. Mm-hmm. And it kind of wakes people up to the fact that there are opportunities within organizations if you take some initiative and actually make things happen for yourself. I think that's probably what I've seen. One of the greatest drivers is that people feel released from some kind of chains, whether they made them themselves or whether they were in some ways hinted at through the organizational culture, an ability to be more free and more themselves. Mm-hmm. And when you kind of get that, there's an indescribable energy and power that starts to radiate through the building. And that kind of magic is almost something that you cannot buy.
We know each other through working at Diageo, and I found that to have an extraordinarily effervescent culture, and one of the values being about being your best and celebrating life. And I think, yes, it was a more of a playful culture than other organisations that I've worked at, but where I see that linkage to performance is really the essence of being comfortable with yourself and being encouraged to be yourself and release your potential. And definitely that drove results, because people were a lot more, you know, ambitious, but they were very clearly aligned to a goal, and they were brought into an environment where, you know, they were challenged and challenging to bring out the best and not so much judge, but have a critical thinking approach to solving problems together.
So to summarise the link between culture, creativity and performance, some of the things that you were talking about were being comfortable in the environment with yourself and also having the encouragement or support to be open and honest. So that really requires your business and your people to be good with transparency and openness as part of your cultural norm.
I think as well that there's an ability to contribute more than just your KPIs. And I think that's also what creative problem solving does. It allows people to actually take initiatives and then actually have the courage and the confidence to actually carry it through and see a result, even if it doesn't necessarily work out as intended. And one of the things that when we did deliberate creative problem solving training within my last organization, which was Perno, we certainly saw that the confidence that we gave people, because we gave them a structure, and they went, yay, this has a structure. Businesses respond very well to structure, and people who are raised in businesses who associate creativity with the arts and suddenly see, oh, it's way beyond the arts. It's a way of thinking. And when you outline that there's a system, there's some tools, and there's some processes, they go, oh my gosh, thank you, I now feel comfortable. That actually put some confidence to it. Mm-hmm. And then what they did was we saw across the board that people actually started to take initiatives on how they communicated, on how they connected, on how they actually helped certain sections of their workforce adjust to changes. I mean, the last business I worked on had the full gamut from people who were contract workers in a vineyard who were not very well paid to senior managers earning hundreds of thousands of dollars in bonuses. And how do you actually make sure that everyone in that business feels equally connected, because the challenges are extremely different and the work styles are extremely different. And you saw that people within a management capability taking initiative to engage these workers, these contract workers, to bring them into the business in new ways, where previously they had just kind of said, that's a problem with our business. Mm. Suddenly they were like, oh, we need to actually act on that. Mm-hmm. And how can we actually do things that will actually help bring them into the fold and recognize that their needs are different? And how do we actually take responsibility rather than assuming that someone else needs to fix it? Mm. So some of those are, and they're not necessarily all huge initiatives, but collectively they can add up to actually making the organization a better place to work and keeping your employees there for longer as well.
So creativity itself is important, but what underlies that to support or enable the creativity is an environment or that cultural foundation of giving people freedom within a framework of operating.
Yes.
So we're going to turn the conversation to the future of work, very topical at the moment because of so much change going on. What's the technology that we need to be able to be competitive globally? How do we embrace our resources to be globally competitive now and into the future? I get a lot of questions around what do you see being the future of work and when is this time frame that I'm thinking of? So if we focus just on the next 5 to 10 years and the future of work, we get some really good insights from economists, from sociologists and industry telling us we need to adapt. One of the statements you have on your website is from the World Economic Forum, their Future of Jobs report. And one of the highlights there that you mentioned was that complex problem solving was sitting underneath many of the job skills that they're looking at for the future. So those including emotional intelligence, cognitive flexibility, and critical thinking. Can you tell me a little bit more about where you see the future of work and the skill set that's important to help us get there?
I think no one can really predict the future. And I think the fact that we actually need to be flexible going into that, because as the future is uncertain, I think it highlights the fact that they are going to have increasing ambiguity. And I'm not quite sure that job security is going to increase. I think it will actually go down, and that we'll have multiple careers and we'll have multiple companies and we'll have to be constantly reinventing ourselves in order to stay relevant. And the speed of technology is changing so rapidly that does impact how we work. And for those of us that are no longer young, you notice how quickly that technology changes and how even the jobs that we do when we're quite skilled at, you can see the next generation coming up with new sets of skills. So I think this ability to not necessarily be bunnies in the headlight, but to actually look to forward to being able to reinvent ourselves and have skills to reinvent ourselves is really going to be critical. Because I think the thing about the future of work is we're going to have to take a lot more self-initiative. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I think we applied for jobs and we expected the company to some degree to look after us, to take care of us, if provided we were loyal. We didn't expect it completely in our generation, but I think there was still a bit of, it wasn't so long ago that if you worked for 5 to 7 years, that was considered to be a good set of time on a resume. Mm. That's a bad set of time on a resume anymore. It's like, oh, you got to get out. No, seriously, you haven't had enough change. Mm. That's what it starts to indicate. You're not dynamic enough. So with all of those things going on, I think it is up to people to actually, for their own self-awareness, their own skills, to increase their curiosity. And that is a key driver of creativity. And to continue to actually foster learning and interest. And that's not necessarily learning tech. Because, yes, that's an aspect of it that you might need for your job and stuff, but it's also almost in the Steve Jobs type of way, which is pursue interests that are exciting to you as well, because you never know where those connections are going to be made or what new opportunities might arise. So it's really about having a curious mindset and not necessarily being fixed on this is the way the past was, so this is the way the future will be. Mm-hmm. It's like, the past is no longer a good predictor of the future, so start to arm yourself, start to actually be more curious, be more awake, be more involved in this world, find opportunities as an adult to continue to learn, to feed your brain, to go out and have experiences. And I think it's important for a full life as well, and not to necessarily be a victim of the work or the changing workplace, and to have a bit more control and direction about where you're going as well.
So the future of work being about personal flexibility, adjusting your style, and in order to meet the changing nature of the environment within which you're working. And that goes for the organisations as well, obviously, being agile and looking at where the market forces are, where the disruption's occurring, and trying to be ahead of the curve. So let's focus on your comments around be more curious, be more open. And if we look at personality styles, there are some styles in us as human beings. Some people are more curious than others. Some people like more structure than others. Some people like to have a methodical approach to doing the day-to-day work and working through their goals. Others like to be more ambitious, more exploratory, and more risk-taking. So we're dealing with a lot of different personality types, and creativity lends itself to some personality types more than others. So to your point, how would somebody who prefers more structure and a more methodical approach, how could they go about taking the initiative to develop a greater creativity?
Well, I think you've touched upon what I would consider one of the myths of creativity, which is that people who are more ideational focused and or who are interested in bright, shiny things, etc., that they're naturally more creative than those that might actually be more considered, more structured, more rigorous, seemingly less curious or less investigative. And that, for me, is not the definition of creativity. I think it's too linked to ideas, and I think the ability to actually ask beautiful questions or the ability to have great knowledge and to go into depth and be deeply curious about something and actually really get rigor and skill there, those are all creative behaviors. But because of the culture of creativity, which has basically really arisen in the 50s, where the Mad Men, so to speak, if you know the show Mad Men, the O in that BDDO agency was a guy called Alex Osborne, and he started brainstorming. And very much they were focused on the big idea. And the word creative as far as a skill or a job didn't actually really start until the 40s and 50s. Otherwise, previously, you were an architect. You were a graphic designer. You weren't a creative. But unfortunately, they encapsulated creativity as the big idea, which is what you need for an advertising campaign. And we've lost sight of the fact that learning how to actually inquire or ask beautiful questions and even to actually go into something deeply are creative skills. So if you look at creativity, there's kind of two types of creative energies. There's divergence, which is that going out there exploring, to some degree that curiosity element. And it's where you kind of suspend judgment and you just kind of go out there and see the world for what it is and seek new opportunities. And then there's a more convergent energy. And it's more about coming down and making considered choices and being more rigorous. Because even if you're out in that divergence phase and you kind of get that aha moment, it's likely that it's not good enough for you to actually do anything much with. And yet you're going to need to go through some kind of convergent process to actually ground it down, test it, trial it. And I think that we only recognize sometimes divergence as being the creative energy and don't appreciate that the fact that it's the balance between the two that is actually really important. And for those that are more convergent in their personality types, recognizing that it is a creative behavior, but maybe encouraging divergence within that conversion phase. So instead of getting locked into a particular solution, remembering that even when you're rigorously analyzing something and coming through with structure, that there are still opportunities to question that structure and to see that structure as a guide and not a firm tramline. And I think that those people who are deeply curious, even about mathematics and stuff, which is a beautiful language, see that for them, it's a language, it's a world, it's a universe within themselves, and they see more opportunities versus someone who's just doing rote problem solving who says like 2 - 4, etc., and doesn't actually necessarily thinking through what they're trying to do with that.
I hear that the key to unlocking creative potential is about embracing all types of cognitive ability and preferences.
Exactly.
And seeing that you might have a certain style preference, but combined with different styles, it's about embracing those differences, bringing those different preferences together and creating something out of that. That's the opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think the mindset is, whether you're in divergence or a convergence phase, is just actually still being curious within those phases and still being aware or seeking opportunities and sensing where things might actually go and not becoming so fixed that there is one answer, the answer, and we need to get to that answer. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking an algebra problem, to some degree, there is an answer. So I'm not saying that everything deserves the power of creative problem solving, but when we're looking at the common type of complex issues that are starting to arise within social interactions and within work, and we're talking about systems thinking, even when you're solving those type of problems, even when you're in convergence, I think you still need to be aware of the divergent energy and keeping open to where that convergence might go to give yourself the best possible solution, not just the solution.
Mm. And that it's not about getting the solution to start off with, but perhaps identifying the problem, being really clear about what the problem is that you're trying to solve, bringing diverse perspectives into the ideation of how we might look at solving that problem, and perhaps testing it.
Yes. You know,
not thinking that we automatically or we need to get to the answer right now, but perhaps let's get 50% or 80% of the way there now and then test it and be open to adjusting that, tweaking that as you go. The essence is about everyone has something to offer.
Absolutely.
In the creative opportunity. Everyone has experiences. Everyone has knowledge about the industry, about being human, and perhaps the problem that they're tackling. So it's about bringing together all of those unique and diverse experiences, skill sets, and preferences that helps you be more robust in your creative problem-solving solutions.
Absolutely. Like I saw a brilliant idea the other day, and it was for a bicycle company, and they are shipping bicycles around the world. And what happens is that the couriers, etc., and the shipping companies are not very kind to these bicycles, and so oftentimes they're arriving damaged into the customers' houses and stuff. And yeah, so there was this pushback on how do we actually design a better box? And so that was the thinking. So how do we actually design this box to be more robust and actually add more cost? And then someone had the brilliance to notice that, hey, when it's a flat screen TV, this doesn't happen. So what they did was they actually didn't change the box at all, other than put a flat screen TV picture on the outside of that box. And that box has now been delivered very carefully. So that's the genius of not necessarily going down and solving for how do we actually put more padding in the box or whatever, and having a bit more curiosity before you jump to solution about what actually is happening and does this happen to everyone with this kind of box infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. And that's what I mean about being curious. And then you've got a problem that's beautifully solved without any more additional waste to the environment.
Makes a lot of sense.
It does, but it's not natural or obvious, do you know what I mean? And that's kind of the genius of it, is that someone actually was curious about what was happening and not just solving for what came up immediately, but looking for the bigger picture.
You're linking it there to also the customer. And I think a core part of this is we're working in industry and in organisations that ultimately are looking to drive value for the customer. So some of the key things that you've spoken about is being curious on behalf of the customer before they get that problem, right? And also having the initiative to do something about it. Obviously, you do a lot of workshops and training or development with people who are seeking to build their capability on creative problem solving. What's some advice you could offer around what could individuals do in an organisational context to look at identifying what problems there are and then filtering those around what are the best problems we could be looking at solving?
One of the things that you can do is learn to be naive again. And if you can't be naive because you've been in your organisation for so long, talk to someone who's just joined. Because they will tell you, why do you do this?
They're so rich in inside, aren't they?
Exactly. You've forgotten one. It's just like, this is the way things are done around here.
That's right. You've sunk into these norms. And
exactly.
You've kind of got these, you know, blinkered glasses on, isn't it, when you've been in an organisation for a long time?
Exactly. And it's kind of that accepting of, this is the way things are around here. Mm. And I think to some degree, we all fall into that trap, whether in our professional lives or our personal lives. We all have blinkers to some degree.
Yep,
where we forget to actually ask why. Learning to ask why. Why do we do things around here this way? And actually starting to understand some of your own frustrations and seeing whether or not there's opportunities to actually look at it differently, whether it's actually changing your attitude towards it or actually seeing if there's opportunities for change or improvement, etc. So yeah, it comes back to being curious is kind of the first step. It's waking yourself up out of your habits, out of your processes, which are perfectly fine. I'm not expecting that if you have a morning routine that works beautifully for you, you don't have to interrupt that. But maybe you can use that time of automation to use your brain to think about something else and to stimulate that awakening and see time maybe a little bit differently. And yeah, just to start to look around, wake up a little bit more, and you'll see some opportunities that you can make a difference. And the other piece of advice I would give is start small. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we get these myths about Tesla and Steve Jobs, and we're just like, we'll never be these people. That's fine. We only need a certain percentage of them on the planet at any one time anyway. It's not about that. It's about making a small difference wherever you can, because a small difference can really make a huge impact on someone's life.
And especially when you're looking at the customer and anyone in that value chain, whether you're frontline facing or somebody that's enabling an output to a customer, everyone has the opportunity to see things differently, the opportunity to make things better or to question why, like as you said, question why are we doing this? Could there be a better way? I think that the real opportunity here for leaders is to encourage that in their teams. I think we're so transactional in the day-to-day that it's just often about getting the job done. But as a leader, the real opportunity you can create for your team is to bring these things to the surface and be a practice or a routine around, well, this week, what sort of issues did you come up against that were frustrating? So setting in systems or practices as a team to bring some of these problems to the surface rather than just accepting them and getting on with the day-to-day transactional work.
Absolutely. And I think that within teams, it starts with allowing the time for a conversation. Organizations, we get very task-oriented. I mean, even the way our KPIs are set up, it's like, do this, you know, grow that. And so you become right in that, okay, how do I achieve this task? And that you forget that the how you achieve it is equally as important as what you achieve. And by having that conversation, it's less about what do we need to do, but also having an opportunity to say, how are we as a team going to get there and help each other to make sure that we meet those needs? And I think that's where you get team trust, teamwork, and you get interactions and natural team dynamics that help support everyone. And that means that when someone's actually not able for whatever reason to meet the needs, that more people are aware and it's more natural to actually give up something that you're doing to help someone else because you've already got the foundations of trust and there's an understanding and a teamwork there.
I'm trying to link it back to things that would be relevant for people in the workplace and really like real problems people are trying to solve. So you work with a lot of different organisations, but are there any common problems that you find that people or teams or businesses are coming up against? You see it over and over again. What's a common problem that you see that is stifling organisations, preventing them from really coming up with the solution to overcome obstacles?
There is a common cultural problem that comes up again and again, which is that how do we balance the tension of wanting our people to be more creative, and yet the fact of the matter is we have some hard business goals that we need to reach, and we do not need them distracted from that. And so it's this dynamic tension between the two of wanting to be better and wanting to actually be more expansive, but the reality is no.
It is a common trade-off, isn't it?
Yes. Like
we need to find opportunity and act on the issues, but we also need to execute and achieve the day-to-day goals and the tasks. Are there any organisations that you have seen approach this? Are there some underlying practices or a mindset that you would recommend helps people manage that trade-off better?
I think it's about being more honest about the fact that these trade-offs do exist. Mm-hmm. That when you set up an innovation team, or even if you don't have an innovation team, but you set up an area that is going to be more future-forward or maybe more risk-taking, you have to understand that you are adding a virus mm-hmm. into the body, so to speak, right. And that there'll be parts of the organization that will actually be threatened by it because you are taking away resources from one part of the organization to feed another part that is yet unproven and uncertain and that you don't know whether or not it's going to deliver the results. Organizations tend to try this and not be honest about the fact that we will be taking resources away from another area to try this and then wanting results too soon. And these other part of the organizations kind of say, ha, I knew it. Give us back our money.
Okay, I told
yes,
you so.
Exactly. 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 It's the attitude of told you so. And I think it's more about honest conversations within workplaces that innovation and trying new things is a risk. It's a cost. But the future of us is not around next quarter, next month, next year. It's around the 5 to 10 year mark. And if we don't try to start to test and try these things now, we will be screwed within 5 to 10 years. And I know it's particularly hard to think about the future because one of the ways that we're set up in business is we're constantly talking about this month, this quarter, this year. We're bonused against this year. So why should I change my behavior? You know, I'm only here for a short period of time. It doesn't matter to me whether or not you do achieve your goals within 3 or 5 years' time. So I also think that the way that the corporate life and corporate measurements set up is fundamentally not supportive of taking risk or thinking differently. And that's hence why a lot of people have to go into a smaller business or a startup to actually be more dynamic and more lean. But the reality is corporates don't necessarily need to act like startups, but they need to actually understand that their future is not predicated on their past, but it's going to be more uncertain, and that they're going to have to at least think about a scenario and consider a scenario where what they do today is no longer relevant, and what plans in place do they have to address that, and how high of a risk do they think that is.
That's a great point, and some of the research that I was involved in with Aon Hewitt was around looking at what are the hallmarks or the characteristics of high-performing organisations, so those organisations that were sustainable, consistently outperforming the market over a lengthy period of time, so 10, 20 years. And quite often you'd find that the companies that were successful 10 years ago are no longer successful. And those ones that have been successful over time have had certain elements within their culture characteristics that has enabled them to be sustainably successful. And one of those elements is having a longer-term view, more longer-term view than the average organisation. And another conversation that I've had with Steve Tai in a previous podcast, he was also emphasising the importance of scenario planning and taking that longer term view. And whilst we can't predict what's going to happen, we can have ideas about what could happen and then road test them with what's going on day to day or month to month or quarter by quarter to see how accurate we are on the different pathways that could be taken. With what you're saying, linking it to research around high-performing organisations having a more longer-term view, it would be important to underpin creative problem-solving, linking it to some of the insights we might have about where we think the future might be going.
Absolutely. The Suncorp organisation, insurance, did a great job with a team within their organisation, and they were talking about driverless cars probably 15 years ago. So I know that it sounds very common today, but back then it was kind of sci-fi and would it or wouldn't happen, but it has a huge impact on how they actually think about insurance and who's responsible should an accident occur. And what they actually did was they did emerging pictures of the future. And I love the idea that they use pictures to get people engaged, mm-hmm. because instead of a 10,000-word report, they've created a room where people could kind of see scenarios of where the future might actually go and start to have conversations and start to actually put themselves in that picture of what would it mean for us? How would our policies change? How would we engage people? Mm-hmm. How does it actually change fundamentally what services that we're offering? And as you said, it's not about deciding that one picture was better than the others, but it's mm-hmm. more about understanding these are potential scenarios and continuing to revisit them, shape them as we get closer to that future and we get new information. And I think that's a gorgeous way of actually getting people engaged in the process that the future is unknown, yet we do have some solid guesses mm-hmm. around what it could be. And if we go there, what does it mean for us as a business about what things we'll need to do differently or what products and services we might have to offer in a different way to meet those needs?
So if you're a business leader in an organisation that is looking for a unique way to remain competitive into the future, a great recommendation that's linked to business results could be create time, build time in your strategic planning process to consider scenarios and create the time with your teams to look at the problems you're finding now, but having a longer term view around what could it look like in the future. And then how could we get ourselves there sooner?
Exactly. It's almost like having early warning systems in place to actually say, if these market dynamics occur, then one of these early warning systems is more likely to occur than the others. But having a watch on the things that would ultimately disrupt your business and seeing whether or not that they're coming, whether you're seeing new technology arising, you're seeing new entrants, you're seeing an interest in startups, but having those early warning systems in place. And I think first and foremost, as part of the strategic planning process, it's not just having a strategic planning process that delivers 1 year out or 2 year out, but a part of it that actually looks at what is the future horizon for us in maybe 5 years, and then what are the things that are going to keep us up late at night or could disrupt our business in the way that we do it, and putting those systems in place and putting someone who enjoys that kind of future forecasting in place to actually start watching for those and letting you know the landscape is changing, and it will be constantly changing. You'll be constantly refining and getting new alerts. Mm-hmm. But having someone who has an eye on that so that the business is not caught completely unawares.
So that's about being proactive and having a proactive framework in place to see what the future could hold and try and work backwards. Yeah. Looking at proactivity, so you're having a structured framework in place, which seems counterintuitive to creativity. But when you look at it, that's the framework you're talking about, isn't it? So having that framework that underpins where you want your business to go, and then having the opportunity then to identify what are the problems that we could be facing along the way, and then how do we use our critical thinking and problem-solving skills to come up with different ideas to solve those problems before we get there. So is that the opportunity for leaders to be more proactive in their with their the way they conduct their business and their teams?
I think it is an aspect of leadership, but I don't know whether it's actually an innate leadership skill. I think there are those that are more interested in the future and are more, it's a sensing skill. Because you can't go into Google and kind of go, what will the future hold? But I do think that recognizing that there are certain people that are more naturally geared towards that and actually enjoy that kind of sensing skill of what the future could offer, or could it go this way, could it go that way, and are very good at reading patterns. In my book, it is strategic thinking. But I think that's not going to be the skill that everyone in a leadership position is going to be naturally geared towards nor necessarily needs to have. But I think for the rest of the leaders, it's also about actually encouraging a workplace where you are actually recognizing that all of your staff have a way to contribute and making sure that you're no longer seen as the leader. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a better name for leaders, because leader implies followers. Mm-hmm. And it also implies that you are setting the direction or that you have the most knowledge. I do think there is a default to hierarchies, and if they're above me, they must know more, or the CEO must know the most, etc. Mm. And the reality is that's no longer existing in businesses, where
it's so true.
Who's seeing what on the front line may be equally as important as what you're actually seeing in the boardroom. So I think for the key skill for leaders today is recognizing that good ideas and I shouldn't just say ideas, but good thoughts and good questions can come from any area of the business. And creating a structure, regardless of the fact of where you sit in the hierarchy, that we can actually access and actually let people offer up those solutions no matter where you sit, and seeing that as a valid business capability. I think it was the IBM report in 2010, and it talked to 1,200 CEOs across 60 countries. And the key creative capability that they identified was creative problem solving, because they realized that they're not going to be able to predict the future anymore, and that their leaders no longer are in positions where they can say yes, no, black, white, right, wrong, this is the answer, and that they're really going to actually have to rely on their people in a new way, because answers are going to be coming from anywhere, and there's going to be lots of patterns out there, and what they need to be able to do is sense and connect the patterns dots and get the most out of people in order to solve complex problems.
If we look at a different definition of leader for the future, would it be somebody that demonstrates the capability of connecting with people and identifying ways to bring collective thoughts and opinions together, filtering those out and coming up with solutions to problems? So it's a problem solver.
I would agree, and that's why I think creative leadership is the next generation of leadership, where it's not about you necessarily having the answers and feeling very comfortable. That is no longer your role, is to have the answers. It's about actually creating the environment that actually enables the most problem-solving capability to come out.
And that's everyone. That's every individual in an organisation has a part to play in creating that environment for themselves, but also for the people around them. And quite often, we look to leaders because people follow leaders. Naturally, that's where we've come from, and that's part of our organisational modus operandi. But in order to really create that fluid environment, it comes down to every single individual and their willingness to challenge the status quo and feel comfortable taking a risk to put themselves on the line. So if I look at that concept of being fearless to really create and live the culture that you want to have, to stimulate the best ideas and stimulate the most proactive and efficient ways of solving problems. Often it's easier for people in that entry level in an organisation. They're into a new role, they're trying to prove themselves, and they're willing to take a few more risks to kind of stand out. And then you get the top, or the higher levels of the organisation, where they've established themselves, they're credible, they're making the decisions for the business, they're kind of untouchable in a way,
yes.
So they're kind of like protected. But then you've got this big middle, and I'm thinking about, you know, senior professionals or middle management, and senior management to some extent, where it seems they have a lot more to lose by challenging the status quo, because if they get it wrong, there's a lot more at stake. I do see in organisations, and I've heard it to be framed in different ways, immobilised middle managers or the frozen group, or that middle management tends to bear the brunt of a lot of problems. But I also think that a lot of this comes down to the culture that is creating that. Because if there's so much risk at that level, of course people are going to be fearful of the outcome. So in order for there to be true creativity and calculated risk-taking at every level of the organisation, we need a culture that embraces failure and sees that as a heroic thing or as a good thing too. It's up to also the senior leaders, the untouchable people, to try and create an environment where people can come from any place in the organisation to escalate something. We're talking about failure and that fear of failure that really holds us back. Where is the opportunity in this for us?
Well, we talk a lot about celebrating failure. And granted, to have an innovative culture or to have more creative problem solving, you're going to have things that are not successful. And in reality is whether or not you even have those two, not everything is going to work as planned. Things will go wrong. But I think it's being careful not to label it as failure. So I'm always kind of, I'll be honest, suspicious of organizations that say, we celebrate failure. Failure is such a loaded word in the English language that I don't think anyone really actually celebrates failure. It is seen, for the most part, as a negative. However, if you talk in terms of experiments, people go, oh, yeah, because experiments are automatically expected that some will work, some won't.
Well, you want failure, so you test your hypotheses.
Exactly. So when you put it into the sense of experiments, you take away the loaded charge or the emotional something went wrong or there's going to be a risk to you, and it's seen for what it is, which is just trying new things that some will work, some won't, you will learn, and you will actually get a greater bank of learnings. But I think to actually actively say we celebrate failure, that's kind of harsh. And I think it's a big thing for people to sign up, because I don't think anyone really in the heart wants to believe that they've failed or they are a failure. Mm. And no matter how much you put the celebrate bit on it, you still hear a very emotionally charged word called failure. So I prefer to take it out of that arena and talk about a culture of experimentation, because I just think that's neutral or even optimistic, and that's what these things are. They're experiments.
So a simple change in language can change the mindset and the relationship to that outcome.
Absolutely. I think it's very powerful, and I think we need to be careful about the power of words and how they actually can change our perceptions or change the way that we look at a problem and how we actually can see possibilities.
Mm. One of the great lessons that I learned in Diageo in that management level was a comment, to care enough that you don't care. And that was something that kind of defrosted me in that sense, where you're like, oh, I could say this, but I'm a little bit worried about the consequences because not everyone will agree with me, or what if it goes wrong? And to have that view of, I care so much about the potential that it could create for solving a problem or taking us down a different pathway, that I care less about my own security or sense of self. I care more about the possibility that I'm going to express myself and do something about it. And that for me was really, really important to unleash some of the concerns I had around failure. That's something I think could help with the immobilised middle, that if we took the view of there's something greater in this than myself alone that could lead to possibility, and if we had that way of thinking in cultures, that could unleash a lot of potential around that middle part.
Agreed. I think there's also something else about this immobilised middle. Now, when I used to do creative problem-solving training at Perna, and we did it across the full organisation and mostly across senior leadership, but oftentimes in that immobilised middle where we'd come into it. And they would spend, and all of the programme took about 7 days, and they would spend all this time and coming up with new ideas, and they got very expansive about what problems they could solve within the organisation and how they could make the organisation better. And as you close down this beautiful 7 days, what you get is, so what is the organisation going to do differently as a result? And it's one of my favorite moments, because I'm like, you are the organization. It's not about actually giving it to HR or giving it to your boss or giving it to the CEO and saying, mate, you need to fix this. I'm like, you are empowered. You have to realize that some of these constraints that you've created of you can't fix this are your own ideas about the way things work around here. I don't see anyone saying, no, you cannot proactively start to solve these things. The CEO put you on this course for a reason. They're not trying to block you, but they are not asking for a new job deliverable, which is true. They're not asking for you to bring this back to them to fix. So what are you going to do about it? Because you felt so passionately about this, that you've worked so long on it to actually come up with solutions. Your solutions right now may be too grandiose or too budget heavy for the organization to impact, but what steps can you take tomorrow to help make this a reality if you passionately believe in your ideas? And really putting the onus back to them, that, and not in a bad way, but saying you are empowered to make changes if you would just see that no one is actively holding you back. It's a real wake-up call for people, because we are very used to, well, what is anyone going to do about it? You know, what are they going to do about it? This place is broken. And it's like, no, it starts with you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so many barriers and similar frustrations where you achieve so much. It's like we make all these commitments, but the biggest challenge is executing that and staying true to yourself and saying, well, actually, it's easier to do this way, but I know the difference is going to be the harder way, and that is to change my behavior or to change the way that we do this and to challenge the norms. And it's so hard to do, but that is where the breakthrough occurs.
Okay, I'm going to change tack a little here. I'd like to ask you about something or someone that you reflect upon to help boost your creative juices or stimulate your creative thinking. So, for example, if you were a great fan of Spider-Man and thought he was pretty classy in solving problems or being creative, you'd ask yourself, well, in this situation, how would Spider-Man do this? So is there anyone that you can think of that you use as an inspiration?
For me, I guess if I look for creative inspiration, it would be Martin Luther King Jr. And one of the reasons why is because I think that when you look back at the time that he was actually talking about equality for people of all colors, etc., I think it was a really stupid idea. We now see it a bit more in the hindsight and kind of actually see, wow, that was amazing. But the concept of I have a dream, and that I was dreaming for the fact that black and whites would actually be treated equal, it was a crazy thought in that period of time in America. And I do like someone who is a dreamer and who actually challenges what we think is acceptable or achievable and believes in it almost to his own peril. And at the end of the day, it was to some degree his own peril. So for me, as far as inspiration goes, the sense that the people that are almost the craziest to some degree have to be the bravest, and they do change the world. Because a lot of times when we talk about those kind of dreaming capabilities, there's another part of us that wants to poop out and say, well, it can't possibly be done. And it's just like, yeah, but it's those people that dream and think about the things that can't possibly get done that make an impact and change the world.
They move everything forward that little bit further.
Exactly. And I'm not saying that you need to be Martin Luther King Jr., but as far as actual things that inspire me, because I passionately believe in the ability to dream is a power that we actively curtail. I mean, anything that we talk about dreaming, we say they have their head in the clouds, they're just a dreamer. You know, get real. You need to get realistic. Well, that's never going to work. And in a sense, it kind of kills our creative spirit. And dreaming is an important part of our creative spirit. So nourishing that and keeping that alive. So as far as personal inspiration goes, that's what's really important for me. As far as professionally, what I've learned to come to terms with is understanding and being comfortable with the fact of how my creativity makes its mark in this world. Because to some degree, I teach about creativity, I train in the area of creativity, and I do have a class of creative people who actually draw or do advertising, etc., who can look at me and say, but you're not a creative. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're holding the tension of actually saying, well, to facilitate a group of people and to take them through a change curve of not believing in themselves to actually releasing their creative confidence, I'm sorry, is a creative behavior. It's just not one that's manifesting in a way that you actually judge creativity. So over time, it's also learning to be comfortable with the fact that I am a creative, but not necessarily in the way that people might point to a creative, and understanding that it's so much more broader than actually just what we call creative people or a creative career or a creative profession.
It's also, like, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly.
Creativity is what we define it to be and what we're confident in it and what our creativity is.
Exactly. And for me, to some degree, it's about facilitation and bringing out the best in people. And for me, what I like to say is your creative self is your best self, and learning to bring your best self more often to more occasions and unleashing that and getting you back in touch with it is a really powerful skill. And that's what I would say is kind of my my secret sauce and my skill. And it's less about, in those cases, looking to someone else to honor that, but making sure that I honor that within myself, and that I don't denigrate it, and that I don't compare it, and that I realize that, yes, it is a creative gift that may not be relevant or may not be appreciated or may not even be seen by everyone to be that, but that I know that the work that I have and the impact that it has, and to honor that.
Mm. And that's a great segue into actually your book that yes. I've read, Connecting, Harnessing Your Emotions to Enhance Your Creativity. I love this book because it made me stop and think.
In the book, you have a great way of challenging us about where do we go for creativity? Where do we go to find that place where we can truly be quiet in our own space and see the power that we have, or the opportunity in doing things differently? And I think this book is a really good way to, like you say, dive in at any point. It can be really spontaneous the way that you approach the book. Thinking about some of the comments that you make, the conflicts that you draw on in those images makes you really think differently. Part of your message here seems to be about owning the fact that everyone has a source of creativity within them. It's about exploring it and finding ways to embrace it, apply it to your work environment, the problems that you come against from day to day, and feeling comfortable that you might not have the answer now, but give yourself some time to ruminate, to think, to challenge yourself, keep exploring. And, you know, at some stage, sooner or later, a different solution might come to you. So it's about being open to the different things that come from solutions and ideas that come from different places that you may not necessarily plan for.
It's also about having an emotional awareness. I think because we associate creativity with ideational type behaviors, and ideation can be very joyful, and it's seen as happy clappy, it's bright colors, and it's, let's just have fun and generate a million ideas. But oftentimes the creative problem solving process is actually a lot more complex than just that one phase of ideational behavior. And that oftentimes it starts from a well of despair or grief or frustration or anger, because those are the things that motivate you to act in life.
True. Sometimes our greatest challenges yes. become our greatest achievements.
Exactly. And so recognizing that instead of trying to shy away from these moments, because I think they're kind of treated as bad or you need to get over it or you hide them from other people, and however you choose to explore it, but recognizing that a lot of your creative power is residing in places you may not feel comfortable going, or you may have been told are not creative sources, but they absolutely are. And actually recognizing that the despairs, the sadness, the frustration and stuff like that are where your creative connections are starting to occur, and where the power for you to actually continue to act is starting to be born. And it's interesting on the car ride over, because it's been a year to almost around this month that my mother actually got sick, and it was kind of the onus for the book and going through a period of grief again. And I think I mentioned to you, we're working on the third book and we got a review from the publisher on Monday, which is basically like, nah, don't like it.
Ouch.
Yeah, it is. And this week has been a week of creative despair. Not knowing how to solve it, there's been some tension, there's been some anxiety, etc. And as I was coming over in the car, where I started to actually go back into myself, and I'm like, yeah, actually look at this whole thing differently. And even this book has been born out of anger and frustration with the way that we think that the world is turning, and that we're not reflecting that honestly enough and having that conversation and starting to think about bringing those themes up and showing not just the end result, but showing how we got there is probably going to be help the publisher to connect the dots more easily, and I think strengthen the work. So it's a half thought still, mm-hmm. but actually once again getting in touch with the fact that when personal creativity, it's just not necessarily born out of unicorns and rainbows. I wish it was. But yeah, it's often drove over something much deeper and sometimes a little bit uncomfortable, but very powerful.
I think that comment itself is very powerful, where, you know, you made the point that creativity comes from emotion. And sometimes those emotions are in places that we don't want to go.
Yes.
But actually by going to those places, we can acknowledge what it is. Not necessarily judge it and criticise ourselves or beat ourselves up for what is or what isn't, but acknowledging the way we feel, but then having the stimulation to do something about it. That's the source of creativity, it would seem.
Exactly. And it actually drives us to act, because not in the sense of I want to escape this moment, but in the sense that I want to actually move on from it successfully, is to almost integrate it. And that's an incredible source of creative thinking, because you start to need to reframe it, and you start to actually say, why am I going through this? Instead of blaming or looking for why should this stop, actually saying, what lessons can I glean from this? How can I actually work this into my story in a way that serves me? And this is really talking now, we've kind of gone away from the organizational, and we're talking very deeply to how creativity impacts us. But the thing about creativity versus innovation, innovation is something that we do usually to drive some kind of monetary result, for the most part. But this is why creativity touches so much more deeply, because it talks to who we are, what we want to be, and who we are becoming.
A very strong point that you made is about being human. And by being human, we have an untapped resource of emotion and understanding of who we are. And by going to that place, we then create opportunity to do something about it. And by having the initiative, creating that personal story and how that sits in the organisational context is where we can unleash our potential and create something better with other people in the work environment to solve problems.
Absolutely. And if I could talk about one key creative behaviour that I think that is the most powerful, if you said, Pauline, I'm going to take away all your other tools and I'm going to leave you with one creative problem-solving tool, what would it be? I would snatch reframing off the table. Really, creative problem-solving at the end of the day is not about new ideas per se, but it's our ability to actually question parameters or question our narrative and actually learn to actually reframe it in a way that works better for us, or reframe it in a way that we can see opportunities. So earlier we were talking about the middle managers being stuck. If you believe that that's true, you will be stuck, and you will accept that as a reality, and you will actually struggle to come out of it. And instead, if you can see yourself, if you are a middle manager, as where can I actually go with that? Why, are these constraints real? Or have I just agreed to a whole bunch of prison cells, so to speak, that may or may not be there? And it's that ability to reframe, to question, and to actually see the world slightly differently. That's the greatest creative problem-solving skill that we have. It's innate in all of us, but sometimes we forget to do it. We accept what's in front of us is what is, instead of actually questioning what is.
Paulina, thank you so much for the time that you have spent with us.
Thank you.
Discussing all manner of things, from being human to the biggest problems we see in the workforce and preparing ourselves for the future. So thank you very much, and I look forward to ongoing conversations.
Fantastic. Thank you.
For more information about Paulina and her work, please visit her website, www.paulinalarocca.com. That's www.paulinalarocca.com. For more information on building innovative work cultures, please contact Angela Lewis at Org Culture Bytes via our email newcustomerinquiry@orgculturebytes.com.